Join the Toronto Holocaust Museum and its partners for a community-wide Yom HaShoah commemoration on Sunday, May 5th. A moving evening of film, candlelighting, music, and a tribute to survivors we've recently lost. Keynote speaker Yoni Berus from Yad Vashem will reflect on Holocaust remembrance post-October 7th. The program is at Beth Emeth Synagogue at 7 p.m. Register at torontoholocaustmuseum.org.
That's what it sounded like a few days ago at Montreal's McGill University, the site of a large and growing student-led pro-Palestinian tent protest. They set it up last Saturday on the lower campus, and the students and their supporters from off-campus have vowed not to take down the 75 tents until McGill and neighboring Concordia University divest of all their ties with Israel, including financial ties with companies who help the Israeli military. On Wednesday, a Jewish lawyer for two McGill students failed to convince a Quebec court judge the tent city had to go. Instead, the judge upheld the protesters' right to free speech, said so far everything has been relatively peaceful, but she warned all the protesters they had to watch their words so it doesn't become illegal hate speech. McGill still wants the protesters gone, and the schools asked police for help, but so far law enforcement hasn't been brought in to clear the campus. While McGill was the first Canadian school where tents went up, similar ones are now dotting campuses at UBC in Vancouver, Ottawa U, McMaster, and Western. Other places, like U of T, want to prevent them from taking root in the first place. And it's all a spillover from the more chaotic situation south of the border that's been engulfing Ivy League schools from Columbia to UCLA.
This is not a peaceful demonstration. This is a dangerous racism, in this case, anti-Semitism, which we should not accept and we should not allow it to raise its head. And we shouldn't be quiet on.
I'm Ellen Besner, and this is what Jewish Canada sounds like for Thursday, May the 2nd, 2024. Welcome to the CJN Daily, a podcast of the Canadian Jewish News, sponsored by Metropia. We'll delve into the situation on the ground in the United States a little bit later in the show, but first to the U of T, where on Sunday, the university sent an email to all staff and students warning there would be consequences if anybody tried anything and put up tents. That would be trespassing, it said. Metal barriers went up near where the convocation ceremonies are about to happen in a couple of weeks. Ofer Baron is an award-winning professor of management at the U of T's Rotman School of Business, and he's Israeli. He also got that email. And while there haven't been any tents spotted yet, and the U of T says they're not aware that any are planned, Baron is still worried because he's about to host a day-long conference at the Rotman building, and he was told to be prepared for it to be disrupted by protesters, even though the subject matter is health data analytics, not Middle East politics. Will Baron cancel? He joins me now to share what the climate is like for him on campus.
Thank you for having me, Lynn.
Why don't you tell me what has happened with a conference you've shepherded for many years that's scheduled to happen in Toronto in May?
So far, nothing happened. This is the seventh year we're doing this. We have speakers, international speakers joining us and local speakers from both industry and academia. And today I've heard that there is a risk that some demonstrations will join the conference and will try to disturb it.
Who did you hear about the risk from?
The co-organizers of the conference kind of told me, hey, look, there were a couple of instances over the last week where demonstrators came to Rotman and kind of disturbed some events. We need to be aware that something like this may happen and we need to decide how we'll deal with it. We're going to have some extra security. There is an extra security in Rotman. As far as I haven't been around, I've been at a conference in the US over the last week or so, but I understood that there's a security person in the school. I'm extremely unhappy about it. Close to 200 people who are suggesting they're going to join the event, which, you know, after COVID has been a little bit hard to get people face to face again and so on. So I was very happy to hear that. And then I heard these fears, and it ruined my mood, to say the least.
Well, why would they target your conference?
My understanding is that this is kind of the call for action is something against Rotman. This event, I'm organizing it, so my name is on the web page. I guess people can find that I'm Israeli from my name.
When you were speaking to these co-organizers, was there any suggestion you should cancel?
No, there was no such suggestion. We just thought about it, kind of say, hey, if you feel that bad about it, maybe we should cancel. But I don't think that was a real suggestion. And my gut response to this, being Israeli, is that terror needs to hit a little bit harder than that in order to cancel events in my end. But the fact that we here in Canada need to think about it at all, even among friends, right, to raise the possibility of canceling an event like this because of illegal disturbances is inappropriate.
Well, it
It's
might
not.
be a little bit more than inappropriate. As an Israeli and as a Jewish professor, you've been here a long time. Is this the first time this has happened to you?
Yes. So in my 20 years in Rotman, I've never felt unsafe, nor at the U of T, certainly not in the Rotman building. On the contrary, I mean, Rotman really proud itself on its diversity and acceptance of everybody. The fact that I'm happy that there is a security person in Rotman today is already a very bad sign to where things have gotten. I didn't move to Canada in order to be afraid of somebody disturbing my work because of my nationality.
What do you want our listeners to know?
My main take is that there is a conflict between the Israelis and the Palestinians in Gaza. It is a painful conflict, but the way I see it, many of the responses here, as you mentioned, some of the responses of universities of students in universities in the US and in Canada are on the border of anti-Semitism and not from the right side of the border, I would say. And I think it is our duty to fight this. It is our duty to bring the right information to people and not to accept these disturbances to our day-to-day life. People who wants to demonstrate legally and lawfully is fully accepted. I am all for freedom of speech. But what we've seen both in social media and in recordings from some of these demonstrations in many universities around the world, this is not a peaceful demonstration. This is a dangerous racism, in this case, anti-Semitism.
Offer, there's been a movement for years to boycott Israeli academics in England. It's really bad, and elsewhere. You're aware, obviously, of that. How is it here in your personal experience with your work? Have you ever faced that or until now, where they're trying to shut you down?
I don't think so. There is a very clear understanding that the academic freedom is important. There is no boycott of Israelis. There's no boycott of North Koreans or Iranians or Russians now with the situation in Ukraine, right? There's the acceptance of others is an extremely important part of it. Violence against others is not verbal violence and not physical violence.
There's convocation now at the U of T, and they put up barricades with like signs and saying you're not allowed to come near the convocation hall and stay off.
I haven't been in U of T since last week, but I've seen some pictures shared with by my colleagues, and it is painful to see this. I was quite shocked when I heard about this as something we need to think about. This is not what U of T stands for. The way I see it, much of the catalyst for what we're seeing in the universities today has started in a congressional hearing south of the border, when three presidents of great universities were an embarrassment to the higher education system.
So what do you want the University of Toronto to do to help you specifically and in general to face what could be an encampment such as we've seen elsewhere?
I want to see a very clear response that what is illegal is being punished by our academic institution in the way it should be.
You're talking suspension, you're talking barring them from campus, things like
Yeah,
academic penalties, failure.
if you are a student, then don't accept the academic code of the university. I don't want you to have a degree from our esteemed institution. I don't want to sign you as a graduate of my institution. When I'm signing on graduates of the University of Toronto, part of the process is that these are well-educated people. Not just that they learn the courses that they have. These are well-educated people. Those are people that know how to behave and they do not break the law. I hope that nothing would happen next week in the roundtable on healthcare analytics that I'm organizing. That's not how it should be, right? And the fact that I say, "Oh, I'm Israeli, so maybe they'll come and disturb this just because I'm there's an Israeli organizer." This is certainly something that, as an academic, I feel very bad about, and as a Canadian, especially.
Brad, if you can hear us, just wanted you to explain the tactics that we're seeing from the NYPD right now. They have just made access into Hamilton Hall.
Those simmering pro-Palestinian protests in the U.S. took a dramatic turn this week after police were deployed in New York to Columbia University, where some protesters had briefly stormed a campus administration building, barricading themselves inside. So to make sense of everything that's been happening, we're joined now by journalist Arno Rosenfeld. He covers anti-Semitism for the Forward newspaper, but he actually got his start as an undergrad in Canada at UBC. He joins me now from New York.
Thanks so much for having me.
Okay, it spilled over into Canada, but we need to find out, you know, whether there's actually some kind of organized movement, who's behind it. What have you been able to learn from your reporting?
It's very dependent on where you are. So far as I can tell, basically what happened was there were a few encampments that sprung up initially on the own, you know, the volition of whoever was involved at the specific campus, including Columbia, Yale, and a couple others. And following that, and following some of the police crackdown, National Students for Justice in Palestine, which is this very, it's like a volunteer run board essentially that coordinates, tries to coordinate some of the local activity, released this campaign called Popular University for Gaza, encouraging people to set up tent encampments. So that's some of it. But, you know, again, they don't have staff that are going around doing this. It's kind of a social media thing. And so I think the encampments that we're actually seeing are largely the result of students. And then, you know, as we've seen to differing levels at different campuses, off-campus supporters who are, you know, setting up tents and participating in these activities. But there's not much, you know, national cohesion, so far as I can tell, beyond the most basic demands. But every school, you know, has a distinct set of demands. There are common themes, but they vary pretty significantly.
Because a lot of social media talk has been, oh, all the tents are the same color, for example.
Yeah.
What do you know about that?
Yeah, that was sort of a goofy kind of conspiracy theory. It was big in New York. We had one of my colleagues looked into it. You know, the mayor of New York was sort of hinting at the same thing. It's first of all, like, not really true when you actually look. There were a couple photos that kind of looked that way. I don't know if they were just from earlier in the encampment. But I think, you know, some people went on Amazon and ordered like $20 tents, because if you don't have a tent and you want a tent, you go find the cheapest one and you might order 10 of them for you and your friends. You know, this idea that things are coordinated, I've seen also with somebody yesterday or the day before was pointing out some people at Columbia were wearing like high-vis safety vests that said faculty on the back from some of the faculty supporters. And someone was demanding to know where they'd come up with the funding for these vests. And I was like, this is, again, it's, you can go to, I don't know what stores in New York sell them, but again, certainly Amazon, you can go get a safety vest for, you know, $15 or something. So I don't think that we've seen anything at these encampments that would suggest that there's, you know, meaningful outside funding. I know in North Carolina, they had, you know, a food table with different snacks and drinks, and some Jewish folks had brought like kosher for Passover food, and they had a Cash App thing, you know, saying, yo, you can send, if you want to reimburse people for who brought the food, you can donate to
like a Venmo or whatever.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So, yeah, that's what I've seen.
But you just mentioned Jewish Passover food. Let's talk about the Jewish community that's part of these protests, because up here, we've also seen Jewish students, Jewish professors are supporting the pro-Palestinian side. Tell me what you've seen.
You know, one interesting sort of reality of campus activism going back several years on college campuses is that almost every, if the school has a sizable Jewish population, almost every Students for Justice in Palestine chapter has a sizable number of Jewish members. Whether or not the school also has a Jewish Voice for Peace chapter, which is sort of the anti-Zionist group that has a big base of support among students. I don't think they're active in Canada, but I think there's another, is it Independent Jewish Voices or some Canadian equivalent. Some people are folks who just incidentally, they might not have a strong Jewish identity. They happen to be Jewish. They're otherwise interested in this activism. But I think for a lot of people, you know, who are involved in these movements from the left, it is what they describe as an expression of their Judaism. They say, I have this connection to the region because many of them have family there, have traveled there. Others just say, I'm Jewish. It's a Jewish country. So that brings me into the activism. And then when I look at the choices, here's where I gravitate toward politically. And I think that, you know, a lot of them are very frustrated, of course, with the idea that these are all anti-Semitic encampments, because they're like, well, what about me? What about my participation?
But so there are Jewish community members that are their Jewish students, because it's more like a tikkun olam, social justice feel, which that's their values. But there have been, and I would like you to talk about what you've seen, cases of serious crossing the line into criminality, incitement and hatred, and even violence.
Yeah, I think it's really important to distinguish between what we can sort of think of as classic anti-Semitism and, you know, what people often call new anti-Semitism, which is stuff related to anti-Zionism. And I think the view for a lot of people in the Jewish community shifted, or at least they became more hardened in their stances post October 7th, because a lot of what we see described as anti-Semitic rhetoric, like the White House condemned anti-Semitism at the Columbia protests, and they seem to be basically referring to chants like globalize the Intifada or from the river to the sea. Almost to a person, the Jewish participants in these protests do not consider that kind of rhetoric to be anti-Semitic, whether or not it's what they use or agree with, especially from the river to the sea, has been, you know, a mainstay chant at these types of protests for 10 or 20 years. And now it is being classified as anti-Semitic. You know, so a lot of that is what's going on. When we see these protests described as anti-Semitic, it's often about that sort of what people consider to be kind of extreme rhetoric about the conflict. But it's more in the political realm. Then we've seen at places like Columbia things that are anti-Semitic in the more classic sense. You know, these comments about go back to Poland or threats of violence toward Jews. Again, it's a little bit complicated because often the threats are being made against counter-protesters who are Jewish, but, you know, they're also holding an Israeli flag or singing the Israeli national anthem. So it's a little bit hard to separate the perhaps impetus for some of this harassment and rhetoric, but we're definitely seeing harassment, toxic language, really aggressive stuff. There hasn't been much violence against, you know, anti-Semitic violence or violence against Jewish students at these protests. If any, it's a little bit hard to separate what's happening on the street outside of Columbia, for example, like the streets of New York City, from the protests themselves. We have seen, you know, overnight we had a reporter at UCLA where actually pro-Israel protesters started physically attacking the protest encampment, including someone who fired a firework basically into the center of the encampment, which then exploded outward. So there have been some of these kind of violent skirmishes on the edges of protests. But you know, I haven't seen anything to suggest that these protests, there's anything that people are chanting about hating Jews or anything that's sort of like overtly anti-Semitic. Sort of
well,
like
well, there was that one 20-year-old student who was like, kill all the Jews. And somebody was stabbed in the eye. One of the leaders saying Zionists don't deserve to live. Are you hearing that these are more isolated? And then the vast majority is kind of uncomfortable, maybe language, as some colleagues have said, but definitely not illegal.
Hate speech is not illegal. You know, generally speaking, in the U.S., if it's not threats, camping out on the lawn, if the university tells you you're not allowed to, could be illegal in the sense that they can classify it as trespassing. But yeah, I mean, I think basically what we're talking about is rhetoric that makes many Jewish students, and especially Jewish students who are close to Hillel and to other kind of mainstream organizations, very uncomfortable. they process that often, I think, as anti-Semitism. I have really seen almost no student-on-student violence. The most that I've seen specifically has been like people throwing water on each other, maybe some pushing and shouting or getting in each other's faces on the edge of these encampments. There's been some very unpleasant stuff, but I think most of it is in the realm of people worrying like, oh my gosh, like if this person is chanting from the river to the sea, we saw October 7th, I care about the Jews in Israel. Does this person think that Hamas should just take over all of Israel and turn it into Palestine and kill all of the Jews? And that feels very scary and menacing, but it's not like everyone at the protest encampments are getting together, you know, at night to read the protocols of the Elders of Zion and, you know, talk about how evil the Jews are.
In Canada, we have different laws than you do. We have the IRA definition. We have hate speech laws. You don't. Vilifying the Holocaust, denigrating and incitement to hatred. You don't have that. So it's a bit different.
I think some of what's going on is a degree of dehumanization. There are Jewish students who have a general attachment to Israel, as of course many Jews do, even if they aren't supporters of the Israeli government or whatever. And when they see this rhetoric about, you know, Zionists don't deserve to live, which is on the extreme end, it's not what we're seeing at most of the demonstrations, but things that, you know, globalize the Intifada, they feel like you must not really understand my humanity, what it means to be Jewish for me, if you think that I am racist because I want there to be a Jewish state. I support a two-state solution instead of a one-state solution, so somehow I'm a racist. And I think that's very alienating for a lot of Jewish students on these campuses. At the same time, you know, I was speaking to a student at Duke, a liberal Zionist student at Duke, where there has been very little pro-Palestinian activity. There's no encampment. And he said, you know, look, I'm glad we're not Columbia. I don't want things to get that, like, toxic and upsetting here. On the other hand, there is a war going on the other side of the world. I think that there is some degree to which Jewish students should feel a little bit uncomfortable. They should have to think about, okay, what do I support? What do I not support? Where do I stand on this conflict? And he was a little bit worried that the choice is between these kind of toxic, upsetting protests and just apathy, that either we're looking at activism that spills into harassment and just a lot of general unpleasantness, or nobody talks about it and everybody just goes around about their business. And, you know, he really wanted some kind of middle ground. So, you know, I thought that was an interesting approach. But yeah, I'd say, you know, Jewish students have a lot of different views on these things.
Well, except that at Cornell, they were told by a rabbi, I think, don't come to class. It's not safe. Stay home today. And all the classes were canceled.
You know, so that was also at Columbia. A professor told students to stay home. But the Hillel said, no, you know, the Hillel said, no, that's not our advice. Like, you don't need to stay home. Not just stay home. He told them to, like, go home for Passover and, like, to leave New York City, basically. Columbia's a bit of a special case. Columbia seems to be basically going through the worst of it. And so it's a little bit hard to generalize from Columbia. The other thing that I would say that I think is really notable is how quickly universities decided to bring in the police and how widespread that now seems to be. I was just, before we got on this call, I was tallying up the arrests, and there have been more than 1,000 people, not all students, but more than 1,000 people, I believe, arrested at colleges and universities over the last 2 weeks at these tent encampments, largely for trespassing. So not for property damage or for, you know, attacking police officers or anything like that, just for being there. They say leave and they don't leave. And, you know, I remember as a student activist, for a long time, there was a lot of this sort of leeway where it was like, yeah, you might technically be trespassing, but if you're camped out in front of the quad to protest, I don't know, the tar sands or Israel, you know, whatever it may be, like, fine, do your thing. Like, you'll be there for a little while. You'll go home. You know, maybe you'll get fined. Maybe you get suspended if you really don't leave. But the police were sort of brought in as a last resort or if things got violent. And now we're seeing, it seems sort of like a first course of action for all of these university leaders. And so I think that's, you know, one alarming trend that a lot of Jewish students are also very concerned about. They're like, hey, I don't like the protest, but I also don't want riot police dragging, like, my classmates, you know, off to jail. So yeah, that's another piece of this.
You've written about or tweeted about, and other people have, that the more the heavy-handedness is used, it only makes things much more tense. And you said, raises support for the protests in the first place, which the universities want to keep quiet and they want to make light a fire, which they did.
It was an interesting poll. I don't know. I don't think it was the most reliable in the world, but there are these folks who do these flash polls. And between the time that the Columbia encampment went up for the first time and then when police tore it down, support for the protests increased significantly among the folks who they were polling, just in the general U.S. population. And, you know, when I was at UNC, you know, we were talking about like I said, you know, 200 protesters in a kind of triangle of grass in a prominent part of campus, but with huge walkways on either side. It wasn't blocking anything. And they had, you know, all of their posters and signs up. And it was, you could tell by looking at it, it was like the lefty kids on campus. You know, it was by fashion and by the signs they had and everything like that. It was like, okay, they're doing their thing. And I saw people walk by, a lot ignored them, some kind of smirked at them. They had a big banner up that said, what have you done today to stop genocide? And some girls walking by and sort of like laughing with her friend. And she was like, oh yeah, like, what have you done today to stop genocide? It was like, okay, yeah, they're doing their thing. We get it. Those are their politics, whatever. And then, you know, 3 or 4 days later, when suddenly there are dozens of riot police on campus dragging these students off, people who might have kind of ignored it or said like, yeah, whatever, that's not my type of politics, are now like, oh my goodness, like, that's scary. Maybe you do know someone who's there. Even if you don't know them well enough, you don't want to go join the protest. So I think that is a risk that we see, is that it's amplifying a message that ostensibly people don't want amplified. And it's also winning more people over, because it turns it into a free speech debate or a debate about police on campus or all these other things. I heard that at Columbia, too, from a pro-Israel student who said, you know, this used to be a debate about Israel, and now it's a debate about free speech, or a debate about whether people should be allowed to protest on campus. And most Columbia students support the right to protest on campus, even if they don't support, you know, BDS or, you know, have the same politics around the war in Gaza. So, yeah, I think that's a real factor.
So what comes next? Passover's over. The semester's over. There's convocation coming. What are you foreseeing is going to happen the next couple of days or week?
I'm kind of surprised that more schools didn't just try to ride this out until the end of the school year. And I think Columbia, especially because Columbia was dealing with like 10 days of class left, I believe. You think you could have just tried to cordon off, you know, the protest for those 10 days. I think we will see graduation ceremonies disrupted. We've already seen some of that. We've seen some canceled at USC, for example, to get ahead of protests. So I think we'll see that. I don't know if there's really anything that schools can do to avoid that. I mean, I guess they could threaten to not let the students who disrupt graduate. I mean, maybe there are things, but I think that's kind of inevitable. But then it's going to be summer. And, you know, we've seen historically in the U.S., at least, it's been different in Europe. I don't know how it's looked in Canada. But like during after the outbreak of the Second Intifada, there was a big spike in anti-Semitism in the U.S. and Europe. In the U.S., it went away after a few weeks. And in Europe, it's kind of stayed elevated really ever since. And so the big question for me is, what happens after the war in Gaza is over? And if that happens while school is, you know, out for summer, which, you know, obviously we hope, you know, that the war comes to an end, that the hostages are released. But if that happens over the summer, I think it's going to be really interesting to see what happens when students return in the fall. And my guess is that the temperature will be significantly lowered. I think people's politics may have shifted, but, you know, kids do have class to go to. They have other things to sort of worry about. And so if there's not an active war going on in the Middle East, I think it will be much less salient for many of them. If the war somehow carries on for many more months, it may be a different story.
And that's what Jewish Canada sounded like for this episode of the CJN Daily, sponsored by Metropia. Integrity, community, quality, and customer care. In Canada, the Jewish community has begun to respond to the campus tent protests. Vancouver had a small group carrying Israeli flags go out to the UBC tent site singing Jewish songs. In Montreal, the lawyer is considering whether to appeal his losing effort to curtail the tent protest at McGill. And later today, pro-Israel groups there are scheduled to hold a counter street rally. Startup Nation and Hillel describe their event as, "They call for our death, so we will celebrate life." The CJN Daily is produced by Zachary Judah Kaufman. Our executive producer is Michael Freeman, and the music is by Dov Beck-Levine. Thanks for listening to the CJN Daily.